God's truth. They keep their old sermons and they file them away and they regurgitate them every 3 or 4 years. I never felt comfortable doing that. If I throw every sermon away, which I have, I might have kept one or two over the years, I'm forced to meet with God every week and ask, God, what am I supposed to talk about today? Now, that's kind of chancy, but that's how I do it. And I'll tell you how I got this one today. This past Thursday, I think it was, I started praying and saying, God, what do you want me to talk about this week? And lots of times when you ask God a question, I've never heard him speak audibly to me. But he lots of times puts a thought, whether it's in your head, your heart, your soul. He gives you some direction. And when I asked that, I felt like God would say, read the book of John. Okay? So I started reading the book of John, and I had my notes there. And sooner or later, something's going to come across that it'll... You know what I mean by when I say an aha moment? Aha! There it is. And I was reading and reading and reading. No aha moments. A lot of neat insights, things I could talk about, but no aha moments. The last chapter, chapter 21, halfway through. Aha! I got it. And who picked the songs for today? Okay, you did it together because each of you were pointing for the other person. But Malachi was pointing mostly to you, Micah. But anyway, you had no idea what I was going to have an aha moment on. And that one song about jumping in the water, that was my aha moment. So we're going to look at that aha moment, and then we'll go on from there. I'm going to open up with John 21. I'm going to read verses 4 through 8. Now, this is one of my favorite chapters in the Bible, partially because it's so full of insights, and partially because this is the chapter that God used to call me into the ministry. Just like Peter was out fishing, and Jesus confronted him, do you love me more than these fish? And 3 times. And finally, Peter gave in and said, you know I love you. Then tend my lamb. But in verse 4 through 8, before that happened, they were out there fishing, and the disciples, I don't know if it was all of them, some were out there fishing, and you ever learned this song when you were a kid? Fished all night, but I caught no fishes. Yeah, that was their answer. And Jesus showed up on the beach here, but when the day was now breaking, Jesus stood on the beach, yet the disciples did not know it was Jesus. So he said to them, children, you don't have any fish, do you? And they answered him, nope. And he said to them, cast your net on the right-hand side of the boat, and you'll find a catch. Well, they had to have a little faith to even do that. Of course, they remember doing that for Jesus a couple times before. So they cast their net, and they were not able to haul it in because of a great number of fish. Therefore, that disciple whom Jesus loved, the whole book talks about the disciple that Jesus loved. Go ahead, John, just say your name. It was John. He's too, I guess, too humble to admit it. It was me. It was me all the time. But I'm able to catch no fish, and therefore the disciple whom Jesus loved said to Peter, it's the Lord. I doubt he said it that timidly. So when Simon Peter heard that it was the Lord, he put on his outer garment on, for he had stripped for work. I guess they fished in their underwear. I don't know. But the next part, it says this, and he threw himself into the sea. He threw himself into the sea. That was one of your songs. Yeah. Now, what's the significance of that? What is the significance of that? And how do we apply that to our lives? Throwing yourself into the sea. I kind of, when I read it, it seemed like it was talking about the sea of life. Okay, your sea. Different than my sea, but you throw yourself into this thing that God has given you. You walk with Him and see where it takes you. Throwing yourself into anything will take some effort. Throwing yourself into anything of value will take more effort. And you can decide not to, or you can decide it's worth the effort. What an awesome privilege we have, if you think about it, that God gives us the freedom and the honor and the privilege to meet with Him personally in prayer. Can you think of anything that would be more awesome than that? There isn't. There isn't. The one that created everything, that we can go to Him anytime we have questions or concerns or worries or fears, and go to Him and say, God, we need your help. And He brings us that help. He not only helps bring it to us, but a lot of times he'll put those thoughts in us. I mentioned this last week when we came back from Seattle and Washington State and Spokane mostly. I found this in a pet store, and it goes in here perfectly. It says this: sometimes faith will make you look stupid. Has faith ever made you look stupid? Yeah. Sometimes faith will make you look stupid until it starts to rain. Noah. Isn't that good? I should probably hang, I was going to hang it over here, but I might hang it on my bathroom mirror so I see it every morning. I don't know what I'll do with it. Some background. Before we get into the specifics, what are we throwing ourselves into? Let's look a little bit about Peter and his personality. Throwing himself into the river, the sea, that really wasn't out of his character. That was his personality. Throw himself fully into what God is calling him to do. The second gospel, Gospel of Mark, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Who wrote the book of Mark? This is the first question. Mark dictated it, I think that's the right word, from Peter. Peter wrote the book of Mark. And Mark just copied it down. And if you notice in Mark, Peter's character, personality, is in about every chapter. Now, remember, Peter was the one who threw himself into the sea to get to Jesus right away. And he wasn't so bashful, he probably wouldn't even put his outer garments back on. But in this chapter, chapter 1, there's a word that Peter uses to dictate this to Mark. He uses it at least 10 times in the first chapter. And it's an action word. And you can see how it goes along with Peter's life when I start pointing these out. So these are from Mark chapter 1, verse 9. In those days, Jesus came from Nazareth in Galilee and was baptized by John in the Jordan. Immediately, he came up out of the water and he saw the heavens opening, the Spirit like a dove descending upon him, and the voice from heaven saying, "This is my beloved Son, in whom I'm well pleased." Verse 12, immediately the Spirit entreated him to go into the desert. Verse 18, immediately they left their nets. A little farther, and James and Zebedee and John and his brother all went after Jesus. Verse 20, immediately he came, he called them, and they left their nets and their father with a hard hand to walk after Jesus. In 21, and they went into Capernaum, and immediately on the Sabbath he entered the synagogue then to teach. Can anybody guess what that word, word I'm referring to, Peter? His lifestyle? It's immediately. We're only halfway done. Turn the page to the second half of chapter 1, verse 28. Immediately the news about him spread everywhere to all the surrounding districts in Galilee. In 29, and immediately after they came out of the synagogue, they came into the house of Simon and Andrew and James and John. Now Simon's mother-in-law was lying sick with a fever. And immediately they spoke to Jesus about her. Verse 42. Immediately the leprosy left him. This is the guy that Jesus prayed for. And he was cleansed. And he was sternly warned, and he, Jesus, sternly warned him and immediately sent him away. Now, if Amy's not here, high school English teacher, that's really not the appropriate word to use 10 times in one little chapter, but this is Peter's personality. Just go for it. Jump right in. He was the one that jumped in. The rest had to row to shore. I'm not waiting for you guys. And I'm sure he beat him there. It was only a 100-yard swim. And also, not in the Bible. Most of them aren't recorded in the Bible. Only one is Jesus. But most of the disciples, apostles, were martyred, killed for their trusting and preaching Jesus. And John was the only one that probably wasn't, although he was thrown into a vat of boiling oil. I think I would have if I had just had my head cut off on that, but he lived. And it came to Peter, and they arrested him. History teaches us, you know how he died? They weren't going to crucify Peter. Only Peter said to them, "I'm not worthy to die the same death that my Jesus died. Could you hang me on the cross upside down?" And that's what they did. I mean, talk about guts and talk about a backbone to make God look more important than himself. That was Peter. And he made some mistakes. But, you know, Peter was one of the closest people that walked with Jesus, and then John. And I think, now he got rebuked by Jesus several times. Remember the time when Jesus took John and Peter, and I think it was Andrew, up to the Mount of Transfiguration. They were up there praying, and all of a sudden, Moses and Elijah appeared to him. Now, how Peter knew it was them, I don't know. You can ask him when you see him. But Jesus, did I build an altar for you and Moses and Elijah? You know what happened next? God spoke to him through an audible voice from heaven and said, Peter, this is my beloved son. Basically, shut up and just listen to him. So he did. So you get rebuked sometimes by being the one that jumps in, but all in all, the track record will win you out because he wants us to be willing to dive in when he gives us something to do. It's an attitude only God can make in us. I wasn't always like that, but I'm becoming that way more and more. So, as a Christian, what are the areas in our life, according to God's word, that we should prioritize in our lives? And I've been reading this thing a long time, almost 50 years, pastor for almost 47 of them. And from my experience, I think I'm able to give you a good idea what the three most important things God wants us to do with our life, prioritizing those three. And the first one is prioritizing your relationship with God. Okay? Now, this goes way beyond just believing in Him. Everybody can believe in Him. Matter of fact, Satan believes in Him a lot more than a lot of church folks do. So it has to go deeper than just believing in Him. And we'll get into that in a minute. But that's the first one, developing a relationship with God. The second is our relationship with our family, our physical family, our wives, our parents, grandparents, kids, grandkids, our physical family. And number three, our relationship towards ministry. And number two and number three, a lot of times cross over, but you got to keep both of them in mind. And I'll explain what I mean about that in a minute. But back to our relationship with God. Can you think of anything that's more amazing than God giving us freedom to connect with Him in prayer? You won't find it. If you think you do, you can tell me and I'll say you're wrong. There isn't anything better. Literally connecting with a living God that wants to be our friend and wants us to be His friend. Not just a belief, but a friendship, a two-way friendship. Anybody ever try to have a friendship one way with somebody? Doesn't work very good. But when it's two ways, and as far as God and us, we should do twice as much listening for Him to speak to us, and only one-third talking. That's why He only gave us one mouth. Is that amazing or what? So we learn to listen even more than talk. But you can do that through worship. You can do that from just praying and listening. You can do it through meeting with God during your devotions. Your devotions are spending time in His love letter that He's written to us. Now, this gets a little, hopefully, convicting to some of us. Now, we can do this. We can get into His Word and read a little bit. Doesn't matter how much, even if it's just 10, 15 minutes, or maybe a chapter or so. You can do that every day out of obligation. You know what obligation means? I know my mom said I have to eat my peas. I hate these peas, but I know if I don't eat them, I won't get any apple pie. You know, that type of a thing, obligation. And I guess obligation, reading God's word to obligation is better than not reading it at all. But it needs to go past that obligation. Here's the next best one, but it's not the best one. I'm going to do this not just out of obligation. I'm going to do this to get knowledge. There's a lot of knowledge in there. I want to be smart. I want to look smart. I want to sound smart. I'm going to read my devotions every day to get smarter and smarter and smarter. Stupid. Waste of your time. So what are you reading your devotions for? This might sound foreign, or it might sound, that's just not clear enough or important enough. You're to be reading. I'm to be reading my devotion every day, a little bit at least, to connect and hear and meet with God. You mean I can meet with God when I'm reading my Bible? How else are you going to get an aha moment? Yeah, that's how it happens. You just meet with him. And you. When I first became a Christian and started doing this, I went hog wild. I mean, I think I read the Bible about a time and a half through the first 6-7 months I was a Christian. I just couldn't get enough of it. But I had to get in the habit of asking him every time when I open my Bible, God, speak to me. Give me some insight that I need to hear from you. And so I copied this little note and I kept it in my Bible where I was going to have my devotions the next day. You know what I told myself? Remember to pray first, stupid. Because I had a tendency to forget to pray first, stupid. So I've remained stupid. No, so I got in that habit of asking God every time, God, no, I want to meet with you today. I don't want to keep my keys out of obligation. I don't want to get head knowledge. I want to meet with you. I know I don't deserve it. But it's you that wants to do it even more than me. I want to meet with God in a personal way and get aha moments. And I'll tell you, if I spend a half hour in the Bible a day, it's a rare time when I don't get an aha moment. That's just the way it works. You need to get in there. But, you know, it takes effort to do that. You don't understand, Jess, I'm a very busy man. You might be a very busy man, but if you're not getting a aha moment, that's a sad person to be. You need it. I need it. And if I'm not willing to put forth the effort to do that, if I'm not willing, ready for this, it won't happen. It's just the way it is. Black and white. If I'm not putting forth the effort to get into God's Word on a regular basis, and I want to connect with God, it just won't happen if I don't put forth the effort. We already had our tombstones made about 5 years ago when my dad passed away and left us this huge inheritance of about $3,000. Marsh got half and I got half, and she wanted a new couch, a bed, a stove. That's what she wanted, a stove. Can you imagine somebody wanting a stove? I got our tombstone, and if I was to do it today, we have something written both by our names there, Marcella and Jeff. But it would have been neat to have Jeff Schindler, a friend of God. Couldn't get any better than that, could it? And it might not be on your tombstone, but that should be your heart's desire, to be a friend of God. Well, number two and number three. Number two is I'll tell you, I find it about the ministering to your family. And number three is about your relationship towards ministering to other people. So they're kind of intertwined in a real sense. But as I go through both of these, you'll see how they're intertwined. But you also see why they're so important. I think I noticed it more putting this together than maybe ever before. Start with pouring yourself into your family. Remember, still going on right now. Marriage counseling seminar. You've done it from you years ago. You got paid to teach out of the Bible. Yes, God can still do a miracle. And the joke was about husband and wife. And the wife was saying to the husband, "You never tell me anymore how much you love me. Why is that?" And the husband said, "I told you I loved you when I married you, and if I change my mind, I'll let you know." That doesn't cut it with too many women. I'm looking for smiles on women's faces right now. How do you do that? It's easier to start, especially with our kids, when they're small. But I know there's several families in here that that didn't happen. And it didn't happen totally because you didn't try. I know that for some of you. But even if it didn't happen, that doesn't give any of us the right to say, well, I guess we just move on. You can't use that as an excuse. You can't use that they're grown up now for an excuse. And if you're still struggling with that, I don't mind if you come to me and say, yes, I'm one of those ones. What do I do? And I'll pray with you, and we'll get some ideas of where to start with that. But don't give up on them. I wrote these in the middle of the night, and I'm having a hard time dealing with my glasses. But we will make it through this. Here we go. If you're not married, or you're not married now, don't just marry someone to get married. Anybody know anybody that had that happen with them? I do. And it doesn't usually end up really good. If you're not married, young folks, older folks, or whatever, don't marry anyone that doesn't love Jesus as much as you. That's as easy as I can say it. Well, how do I find that person? Probably stop looking and let God bring them to you. So I don't know. I could pray with you over that too. But you have to be like-minded in your marriage. You both have to be sold out to God. You know what I wrote next? Is I took this from a guy that I know that didn't do that. Waiting for someone to be sold out to God as much as he was. And he ended up marrying a lady that was sold out to herself. You know what I'm saying? Not good. So if you're going to all those then kids back there, are they taking all this in? Making that for you. Are you just making this in? Don't marry anyone. Don't even consider dating them if they don't love Jesus as much as you. And you will be so thankful. This will be the top list of your sermons once you're married 50 years, like Marsh and I almost are. I am so glad we showed up to Pennsylvania. And here Jess said, don't marry anyone that's not as excited about God as I am. There's a verse that came to my mind. Kind of goes into number three, but like I said, they play back and forth. Keeping your family as your priority disciple. You know what I mean by that? Micah, you have 11 people in your life that are your primary. You know the word I'm trying to say. Esther and your 10 leaders. They will be your primarily important disciples the rest of your life. And then you probably add about another 10 and they get hooked up with somebody. They can expand and grow. But keep them as important, most important disciples you have. I asked myself a question. And you know what I do when I ask myself a question, right? I go to, bing, on the computer, my favorite go-to, whatever you call it. So I went to Bing and asked Bing this question. Bing, how many of Jesus' 10 or 12 disciples were married? Did you know the answer to that? I didn't either. I had no idea. I knew Peter was because he lived with his mother and father-in-law. It says that in the Bible, at least his mother-in-law. There's indications that Judas was the guy that turned Jesus in. He even had some kids. But I didn't know about the rest. And let's look at this verse. I read over this verse many times and I never noticed it. 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 5. This is Paul speaking, inspired by God, and he says this in verse 5. Do we not have a right to take along a believing wife, even as the rest of the apostles and the brothers of the Lord? Brothers were Jesus and Jude. They were brothers of Jesus. And they were going out and ministering too. And Cephas, that was another name for Peter. So he's saying, do we not have the right to take along a believing wife, even as the rest of the disciples did? So my understanding, probably most of them were married. But they brought their wives along with them. It was important, more so even back then than today, to have a wife, especially one that could give you children. That's how it was viewed during that altered time of life. And so they probably had some too. So what did they do with their wives? I'm guessing they talked them into going to church and maybe helping with Sunday school. My guess is they talked their wives into coming and helping start a kids camp 35 years ago when we had two counselors, one for the guy who walked off the job halfway through camp because I just can't take it. And where did this guy go? Winston. Oh, he said he was going home for good. And he did. So the other one was the female counselor. I mean, we only started maybe 20 kids, but she was the female counselor. And now she had to become the female and the male counselor. And I can still remember, some of you know where Jesse Fritz lived, of course, Benton. He had a retreat center. We rented the first 2 or 3 years of camp before we started one here. And they had these high weeds, full field of high weeds. They're called goldenrod. You know what goldenrod is? High as heaven? Oh, well. So she had to take these kids through this obstacle course, like a corn maze type of thing, mowed through all these allergy-filled weeds. they got lost big time. And then to top it off, the dinner bell rang. Time for lunch. The guys started literally crying. We're not going to get any food. We're lost here forever. No one of those kids, and I don't think you would mind me telling you, Caleb Britt, he grew up to be a pastor. Well, he was lost in that maze with the rest of them. And now he's a pastor in the area. So at the end of the first week, the only week, I set the whole staff down and said, you guys really did a good job. Really give it all. I think God is calling us to do this for 2 weeks next year. And almost every lady started crying.
No!
If you've been here in the last 10 years, you know what it's like. Still be here today or not? Not yet. But you can ask for all you Sylvia related people. He cooked with her helpers for well over 100, 150 people a day, kids and staff, 3 times a day for 2 whole weeks. It's not an easy thing. If you found something of value and worth, you just throw yourself into the sea. And that's how it plays out. Nobody cried after that first year when you found out, not that bad, is it? She didn't cry. She gave me a look, but she didn't cry. So you bring your family along as much as you can, just like probably the disciples did. And it's obvious that some of them did. Many of them did, according to that verse. Whether it's a kids' camp or church ministry or whatever, you just try to include them in your ministry. You learn to live for something bigger than yourself. You understand what I said? You learn to throw yourself into something bigger than you could ever possibly do yourself. You can't start a church yourself. You can't start a kids' camp yourself. And now I have 20 grandkids thus far to pour myself into, and Marcy pour herself into. Everybody noticed we had little Ella up there. Andrew's little one, little girl. I finally got their little girl. They'd have 20-some kids already now. They're still waiting for the little girl. But we got ours after 4. So we it's birth. I looked over and said, he's 1/3 you. 1/4 you. Yes, 1/4. Thank you for questioning me. And I said, I think it's a pretty face. But anyway, we have the family that you have. And some of them don't want to be poured into, but you love them anyway. And you tell them the good things that God's doing in your life as if they really want to know. Because in the bottom line, they really do want to know. You just are maybe too ashamed or bashful to ask. So you share all those good things with them that God's doing in your life to impart this love for Jesus. And the sooner the better. But I started doing that with my great-grandfather when he was 97. Would there be any hope for a 97-year-old? I've told this story many a time. I went and spent that day with him when he was 97, living in a nursing home over in Berwick. And he gave his life to Jesus at 97. And 3 days later, he died. I am so glad I did that. So don't ever say, well, they're too old or they're too mature or they're too far out there on their own. I'm going to close with one verse. It's back in in John chapter 21. It was when Jesus was telling them to, especially Peter, "You love me, feed my sheep, take care of my lamb." And I think Peter was finally catching up in verse 19. Peter was grieved because Jesus said to him a third time, "Do you love me?" And he said to the Lord, "Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you." And Jesus said to him, "In my land." And that doesn't have to be just a pastor. We're all called to do that, especially with our family, especially with our kids. And then I'm going to close with this thought. Jesus closed this thought with this too, verse 18. "Truly, truly," and he's speaking to Peter here, "Peter, truly, truly, I say to you, when you were younger, you used to gird yourself up and walk wherever you wish." Doesn't that sound like us as teenagers? That was me. "But when you grow old, you will stretch out your hands and someone else will gird you and bring you enough to where you do not wish to go." Now this Jesus said, signifying what kind of a death he would glorify God with. Remember I talked about that. Not only dying on the cross, but dying upside down because he didn't deserve to have the glory of dying the same way as Jesus did. "And when he had spoken this, he said to Peter, 'Follow me.' Peter, turning around, saw the disciple whom Jesus loved following him." There's that guy always getting called the one he loves. And one who also leaned against his bosom in the Last Supper and said, "Lord, who is the one who's betraying you?" So Peter, seeing him, said to Jesus, "Lord, what about him?" Does that ring a bell maybe with some of you? "Why are you asking me to do this? What about this guy? What about that woman? Why aren't they doing that?" And this was Jesus' reply to Peter. Again, kind of a slap in the face, but sometimes we need slaps in the face. Jesus said to him, "If I want him to remain until I come, what is that to you? You follow me." So it's not a thing to be concerned about what other people are being told to do or what they're doing or not doing. It's what is God telling you to do? And am I willing to jump in to see a life, see a walking with God, do whatever I feel like he's encouraged me to do? And if you have questions about any of those things, number one, they'll always line up with the God's word. They'll never ask you to do something that's against his word. Number two, that's why he's giving you other mature people to say, hey, pastor, this is what I think God's told me to do. Does that sound like something I should do, or am I just full of baloney? That's all right to get input from other mature brothers. But don't just brush it off. "Oh, I don't feel like jumping." If you're not willing to put forth the effort, you're not going to get the result. It's just that simple, just everybody. So God, I thank you for giving us opportunity to jump in. And if we don't know where to jump, we would take these three areas back and pray about them, and you would give us some pointers how to start. If nothing comes to mind, the pastor saying, come to him and ask, and he'll pray with me, and maybe together we'll get some ideas. But don't just discard them. We want to be led by you, God. We want to be your friend. We want to learn to distinguish your voice.